first layer is, can we acknowledge that in a country that has only elected male presidents throughout its history, that gender is a factor?
Peeling away the many layers of the Warren Sanders sexism sideshow. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Also on the show, are you depressed by politics? This guy has a plan for that.
There's something you can do, and it's getting power for your side, for your views. And that requires you to change people's minds about whether they're going to vote and who they're going to vote for.
Plus, a journalist researching her book about the Trump and Kushner families found herself on the slippery slope of the new normal. Nevertheless, she persisted.
There's only one thing I can do, which is to try to document and put something into a story that people will understand. The moment that I stop doing that is when I have given up hope, and I have not given up hope.
It's all coming up after this.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
It's time to play Family Feud!
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Tonight, Family Feud. Progressive Democratic presidential contenders Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren sparring over questions of gender and electability.
And Family Feud. Going into tonight's Democratic debate, the last before Iowa, a fight breaks out between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
The rare progressive family feud coming after Senator Elizabeth Warren confirmed reports that during a private conversation with Senator Bernie Sanders in 2018, he told her a woman could not beat President Trump.
The de facto non-aggression pact between the two progressive senators seems to be out the door.
It started last weekend when Politico reported that the Sanders campaign had given some volunteers a script with talking points for winning away voters who were leaning toward other candidates, including Warren. Then CNN reported its bombshell.
Sanders told Warren he did not believe a woman could win, according to four sources, two people Warren spoke with directly and two others familiar with the meeting.
The gossip that routinely stands in for actual election news, like one of those tasty pirouette cookies that melts in your mouth, leaving nothing behind but a sugary residue. CNN made much of its nothing.
Anderson, there is no question that we've seen debates before. We've not seen a debate like this.
We are just about an hour away. Will tension between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders finally boil over?
That's the big question. That is what everyone is waiting to see.
The debate was 2 hours long, the last before the Iowa caucus. But for CNN, it was all about that last 17 seconds.
They had a moment after the debate. Warren left Bernie Sanders hanging when he tried to shake her hand, and that was followed by a brief but tense exchange, including Sanders' hand gestures and a return of a gesture there from Elizabeth Warren.
What could the silent gestures have meant? Politico got a body language expert to do a move-by-move analysis of their exchange. News outlets noted that hashtag NeverWarren had begun trending on Twitter.
There were Bernie supporters who were lighting up Twitter yesterday with anti-Warren hashtags.
It wasn't trending because a critical mass of voters were turning on Warren, but because the algorithm had picked up on users cautioning one another from tweeting the hashtag. Like a finger trap, the harder progressives tried to de-escalate, the more the feuding seemed to spread, drawing more eyeballs, more clicks. And then, just as the post-debate news cycle had reached its natural crescendo, CNN released audio of the handshake snub during Anderson Cooper's primetime slot.
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
What?
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
Let's not do it right now. You want to have that discussion, we'll have that
Anytime.
Discussion. You called me. You told me. All right, let's not do it now.
It was a soup to nuts CNN win, a well-timed, anonymously sourced piece that produced days of TV drama. But did the feud tell us anything new about Sanders or Warren or how they'd govern? And given our country's history of misogyny, was it even sexist for Sanders, if he really said it, to suggest that a female candidate faced insurmountable odds? Writing in The Cut this week, Rebecca Traister says the question, though dispiriting, is inevitable.
Can we acknowledge that in a country that has only elected male presidents throughout its history, that gender is a factor both in all of the elections of men that have preceded us and is a factor that's going to shape the path of female candidates in such a way that it certainly had an impact on Hillary Clinton in 2016. But it's like people then, when they get to the point where they can acknowledge that, speed right by it and get to, well, it's impossible. We'll never be able to elect a woman because everything's so sexist. It's somewhere in that middle ground that we are right now.
Warren, until now, hasn't directly taken on questions of whether she is a woman is electable.
I have been watching her framing of gender with tremendous interest. She gave her opening speech in Lawrence, Massachusetts, talking about young women who organized in the textile mills in Lawrence and Lowell, Massachusetts, in the early 19th century.
On January 11th, 1912, a group of women who worked right here at the Everett Mill discovered that their bosses had cut their pay. And that was it. The women said, enough is enough.
She gave a big speech in Washington Square Park in New York in the summer about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory and the kind of organizing and striking that had preceded the fire there, and then specifically about Frances Perkins, mm-hmm. who had witnessed that fire and then went on to work in Roosevelt's cabinet. And without talking about herself, she was making a not-so-subtle comparison between how a woman can look at systems that are broken and then move inside a system and fix what's broken. And it does two things. It enables a feminist approach to her historic presidential campaign without having to engage the incredible tinderbox that is about her own experiences of bias or sexism.
And you said, all that's over now. We're in the muck.
Sure are. Yes. that's done.
Because then on Monday, CNN reported that in 2018, multiple sources say, none of whom were Warren or Sanders, that in a private conversation, Sanders told Warren he didn't believe a woman could win. When he was asked about this during the debate, he was emphatic.
It's incomprehensible that I would think that a woman could not be president of the United States. Go to YouTube today.
One of the things the Sanders campaign has said in its defense in this conversation is, here, look at these videos of Bernie Sanders talking in 1987 to school children, third graders.
You, just as much as the boys, have a right to become president. There's not been a woman president.
And then in 1988, telling C-SPAN, of course a woman can be president. There's a difference between saying in 1987 and 1988 that in theory, yes, of course a woman can be president. And the question of a woman running against Donald Trump. And I can absolutely imagine a scenario where Bernie Sanders says he's going to throw everything at you. He's going to drag you through the mud. And Warren says, so do you think any woman can beat him? And I can mm-hmm. imagine him not thinking that he was giving any kind of definitive prediction and it hitting her like a ton of bricks, because it's mm-hmm. her prospects that her friend and colleague and feminist is describing. When she ran in Massachusetts for the Senate seat that was then occupied by the very popular Republican Scott Brown, she told me in the summer of 2018, just a few months before this dinner with Bernie Sanders, how clearly she remembered the progressives, her friends, who called her and said, you can run for this, but you should know that a woman is never going to win in Massachusetts. Scott Brown mm-hmm. had beaten another female candidate, Martha Coakley, to win his seat in 2010. Massachusetts had a terrible record of electing women in politics prior to Elizabeth Warren. And Warren was so frustrated. So it doesn't surprise me at all that if there was a conversation, which Bernie Sanders might legitimately not have thought he was offering any definitive prediction of doom, but she being very sensitive to all the ways in which she's been told women can't do this in the past, heard it. I think people have exchanges like that all the time in which meaning is extracted differently.
But Twitter's gone bananas.
Yes, of course it has. This is the first time in my life that there has been this kind of competition in a presidential context between two such left-leaning politicians. And people are driven by their passions for these politicians. And it's been a very tricky proposition for Warren and Sanders fans, because they went in with a kind of truce, and yet they both want to win. But the complaint that I had about Bernie's response was he said, no one in this room thinks a woman can't win the presidency. No one says that. And that is simply not true. As a feminist journalist who has written about this for years, I have had thousands of conversations with people, some of whom are like jerky sexists or whatever, but most of whom are fellow feminists who are deeply worried about this question. And by the way, I absolutely believe that a woman can be elected president in 2020. I believe that there is every chance in the world that Elizabeth Warren could be elected president in 2020. But the thing that is not true is that no one would say that. We have never managed to do it before, and women are more than half of the population. The only way we ever will elect a woman is if we all decide we want to elect a particular candidate who is a woman and we get over the fears that we can't do it. I mean, that's the catch-22 here, is the more this question guides our thinking, the more it becomes self-fulfilling prophecy, because we worry about it so much that we reach for what looks like the past that we know we have elected in the past, like Joe Biden, who's literally been in power for 5 decades.
After Bernie made his statements, the moderator turned to Warren and said,
Senator Warren, what did you think when Senator Sanders told you a woman could not win the election?
As if Sanders had never spoken at all.
So I thought the phrasing of that question, which just took as gospel Warren's recollection and openly rebuffed what Bernie Sanders had just said, was really irresponsible. I also thought it was bad for both of them. It is obviously bad for Bernie because the moderators who are framing the terms of this discussion, in that moment, they're not even registering his differing view of events. So it's obviously bad for Bernie in that way. But it is also bad for Warren because, of course, Bernie's fans hear that, understand it to be a sign that he is being victimized in this. And these are the dynamics that are so perilous whenever you have a conversation about sexism. The power dynamics are so easily reversed so that the marginalized person becomes the aggressor, and the person who in any way is asserted to profit from marginalization becomes the attacked. And so the fact that Bernie is in fact treated badly by CNN becomes more evidence that he has been wronged in this situation. And that's not good for Warren. But we also need to talk about the timing of the CNN piece. And I want to do this without in any way impugning MJ Lee, who is a terrific reporter who wrote the piece and has been a great reporter on the Warren beat.
But the timing
of a piece, it didn't come out of a conversation that happened on Sunday. It didn't have to be published right now. There was a choice made by CNN to publish it on Monday before a Wednesday debate that was aired on CNN that published the piece.
The ratings for the debates have declined. The first one drew 18 million. The last one drew a little over 6 million. CNN got 7.3 million for this one.
I don't think there's any way to say that there wasn't thinking that this is going to draw attention. We can't take a look at all of this that's happening between the candidates and assume it's just happening in nature.
Let me pick up on women's anger. I think that there's been just as much commentary about that final moment. She gave Bernie the cold shoulder. As you've observed, women in public suffer far more than men for lying.
Characterizations of dishonesty do stick really hard to women, not exclusively women, but they stick really hard to women candidates, something we saw in 2016 around Hillary Clinton, who sort of by every factual measure was actually a fairly straightforward politician and yet got incessantly tagged as devious, conniving, untruthful, dishonest. We've seen that with Warren, I think, in part criticism around her handling of the DNA question and stuff that Trump has been throwing at her for a while. She's gotten this stuck to her very early, and it's not rational. I actually wrote a piece a few weeks ago about how her competitors, including Joe Biden, right? Like Joe Biden is a guy who was thrown out of the presidential primary in 1988 for plagiarism. And not only that, lying about his own academic record. He's been caught in a million of these. And yet he has this like no malarkey Joe reputation. It doesn't stick to him as a character trait. But the littlest things have gotten stuck to Warren. And again, I want to be clear. This isn't something that happens exclusively to women. It also happened to John Kerry. It happened to Al Gore. Although I would note that both of those men also wound up being feminized by the press in their presidential runs.
Frenchness of John Kerry?
The Frenchness, the wealth, parasailing, his thrall to his very powerful wife, Teresa, who was wealthier than he, right? And Gore, who, if you remember, Maureen Dowd once described as practically lactating. There are strong associations between femininity and dishonesty that actually the very brilliant scholar Salome Shatila told me in 2016 in reference to Hillary Clinton, it's almost biblical. So the question of did Elizabeth Warren lie, it is a very perilous moment for her in that regard. The question of anger and how she presents herself is a slightly separate question. She has been relentlessly upbeat. She's got the energy of the golden retriever, right? That's like her mascot.
Kate McKinnon captures it perfectly.
Hello, Vinton. Hello. It is good to be here. Look at me. I am in my natural habitat, public school on a weekend.
But she's very smart and can be very cutting. And of course, she can get angry. And she's talked about anger unapologetically throughout. She was talking about it in the wake of the Kavanaugh hearings. She was saying, I'm not going to apologize for my anger. I own my anger.
Bernie says he's sick and tired all the time.
All men on campaign trails get to be angry. In men, it's a sign of passion, commitment, drive, patriotism. We know that there are these double standards. Warren has actually been pretty direct, I think experimental, in her willingness to say, yeah, I am angry, and that's part of what's driving me. She talks regularly about being in a fight. And what you saw at the end of the debate was a moment I actually thought it was incredibly humanizing for both of them. They are longtime colleagues, longtime friends, who are both in this election because they are so committed to trying to fix everything that is unjust and broken in this world. I really believe that about both of them. And now they're in conflict with each other and they were mad at each other. To me, it was so human about both of them. They're mad. This is ugly. This hurts. I don't think either one of them is lying. And I write a lot about how women get criticized for being angry all the time and men often get congratulated. And Bernie has been congratulated for conveying the anger of his supporters so effectively. But it is also true that Bernie is one of the men who's also been criticized for it. I mean, he is also a real challenge to the power structure. And part of how he's punished for that is through characterizations of his own bad temper. He yells and he hectors and he points and all of that.
You've observed that getting to cry sexism is treated as a privilege, as a present. And on MSNBC, Chris Matthews was praising Warren's canny handling of the issue with his usual frenzy.
All right, and I think bringing this out into the open, the issue of whether a woman can be elected president is going to help her campaign. And whether she started it or not, she definitely brilliantly exploited it tonight. And then Bernie clinched. I thought it was very interesting. He did not want to fight it anymore, but she won.
This is one of the perils of ever talking about the bias that you have faced. You will be perceived as having won the lottery because you get to talk about how you've been discriminated against. It's all tied to the reactionary inverted views of affirmative action or identity politics, where it's worse to be called racist or sexist than it is to experience racism or sexism. That is such a popular ingrained assumption. I think in so many of the people who run our media institutions, which are still fundamentally white patriarchal media institutions, that like the greatest danger is that somebody might call you a bigot, not that that person might have experienced bigotry.
Rebecca, thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure.
Rebecca Traister is a writer at The Cut, where her recent article is called The Third Rail of Calling Sexism. Coming up, does consuming all that politics make you depressed? Our next guest has a plan for that. This is On the Media.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. So, did you tweet while you watched the Democratic debate? Did you catch the Lev Parnas interview on the Rachel Maddow show and share something about it on Facebook to inform your friends? After all, you're politically active. You're civically engaged. You listen to this show, after all. Eitan Hersh is the author of a new book, Politics is for Power, How to Move Beyond Political Hobbyism, Take Action, and Make Real Change. In 2018, a year of midterm elections, Hersh, a political science professor at Tufts University, asked a random sample of 1,000 Americans how much time they spend on political activities. A third of them said they spend 2 hours or more each day on politics. 2 hours a day devoted to politics, to civic engagement. Wow. But wait. 4 out of 5 said that the time is not spent on any real work, organizing, volunteering, anything active. And of those 1 in 5 who said they were actually doing anything, the amount of time they devoted to political work was infinitesimal.
They read the newspaper, they listen to NPR, and then they could listen to a bunch of podcasts or watch MSNBC or Fox News for hours. And even if the stuff they're learning about is, you know, gossip and minutia, they'll say, ah, it's my civic duty to be informed. But if you ask them, like, okay, well, who should I vote for in a local election? They would say, I have no idea. I don't know anything about the local elections. I don't know anything about this state. I really could just tell you a lot about Moisturegate, Sharpiegate, the Mueller investigation, but I can't tell you a thing that would actually inform your vote.
You found political hobbyism is a bigger problem for Democrats?
Well, it's a big problem for people who are college-educated news followers. And right now, those people are overwhelmingly Democratic. They think about politics as their civic duty, and they're in a social network where people talk about politics. But if you ask them, oh, can you come to this community meeting where we're going to do something, they would say, ah, I don't really have time for that. The status quo, as much as people might lament it, is pretty good for people like me, for college-educated white men. They don't feel particularly under threat. So they might say, oh, you know, Trump's awful, or Obama's awful, or polarization is awful. You don't see them out there doing anything about it.
A college grad isn't so special anymore as it was a generation or two back. We don't feel that the nation depends on us.
That's right. At the same time as the college degree population has skyrocketed, say, since the 1950s, civic engagement has declined rapidly. Since 1952, the American National Election Studies has asked every year how interested you are in the election. And 2016 was the peak. 2016 was the high point of interest. But when it came to saying you volunteered, you worked for a party organization, you worked for a campaign, 2016 was below the historical average.
You also suggest women spend less time on social media, but they spend more time actually doing political work.
Yeah, this is an amazing thing that you can see anytime if you go talk to a group on the left, say like an Indivisible group, or even on the right, like in church groups, the people there are almost all, you know, are predominantly women.
Right at the start of your book, you described sitting on the couch, quote, a pile of laundry sits next to me. Over some 2 hours, I folded half-heartedly as I watch TV and clutch my phone. I refresh my Twitter feed to keep up with the latest political crisis, then toggle over to Facebook to read clickbait news stories, then over to YouTube to see a montage of juicy clips from the latest congressional hearing. I then complain to my family about all the things I don't like that I have seen. What I am doing, you say, isn't politics. It's political hobbyism.
Well, in this book, I follow about seven organizers, and they are people who are trying to get power. They have community associations that are designed to win over people to their side. They're clearly doing politics. That is, they're trying to get power. And the way they're getting power is by essentially serving other people so that those other people who maybe don't care so much about politics will give them their votes. The rest of us, what we're doing is not trying to really get power. Maybe we don't want it so bad as we say we do. Maybe we don't know how. They know how to throw $5 donations at a candidate. They know how to vote in a presidential election. But they don't really think about, well, okay, what can I do locally that actually multiplies my own vote into more votes?
You start the book with an anecdote. It takes place in a Republican stronghold in Pennsylvania. A few lonely liberals rattling around a hall trying to organize.
Yeah, there's this woman, Angela Aldous, a nurse who started this group. And at first I see this room of about 50 people who they looked like they could be a variety of mostly retired liberals anywhere in the country. And in walks this guy who sits at my table who looks very different. He has this big, thick beard. And he introduces himself. This is a liberal organization in this Republican stronghold. And he tells everyone at this table that he's an evangelical Christian and he's pro-life and he's Republican. At first, you can see the people at this table squirming. And you have to understand the background is this organization is of people who knock on their doors of their neighbors. Sometimes they wear Kevlar vests. They're afraid to talk to their neighbors and try to convince them to vote mostly for Democrats. And so they see this guy, and it turns out that he was really upset about some of the behavior of the president, and he felt like his community of evangelical Christians in this town were going down a path that he thought was racist, and he wanted to see what this liberal organization was like.
And it's no accident, you write, that he showed up there. His appearance was the product of a tremendous amount of work on the ground.
And also an attitude by the leaders of this organization that this has got to be a slow and steady organization that's welcoming to a very diverse range of people because you can't win in Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania, the way you can win in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And so they welcome him. And sure enough, a few months later, I get text message from Angela, the lead organizer in this group, of her canvassing with this gentleman, getting people to vote for state and local offices for the Democratic Party. I totally changed my image of politics writing this book because the way I thought about it as a political science professor and as a national news reader is, what difference can any person make? We're such a small drop in the bucket compared to the whole large country. But the organizers don't think about it that way. The organizers think, okay, I have my one vote. How many more do I have in me to get? In the book, we encounter this old man, Nach Vysocki, who's been called the Ukrainian boss, who over a couple decades influenced 1,000 votes. This precinct of retired refugees from the former USSR had 2 or 3 times the turnout every election than the precincts around it. That's one guy with 1,000 votes.
How'd he do that?
The same way all these people do it, which is by building rapport with their neighbors. This guy drove his neighbors to doctor's offices. He helped them study for their citizenship tests. In the end, he didn't have to persuade them that any one candidate was great. They just know that he's great. And that's why they give them their vote. And this is like such an important lesson. If you're not in an organization and you don't rely on other people, then if a candidate's not a star, it's not Barack Obama, it's not Donald Trump, it's not a celebrity, or maybe at a time where your party is down, like at 2010 for the Democrats, you stay home because it's the party or the candidate that's inspiring you or not inspiring you. But when you're in a community of organizers, when you're in maybe a church community, then the reason you vote in any election is not because of who the celebrity on the ballot is. It's because your buddy who you trust says, hey, we got to go vote. You see right now on the right among evangelical Christians say, some of whom really don't like Donald Trump, don't like his tweets, don't want him teaching their Sunday school kids. They say, hey, this guy is the vehicle for our values, so we got to do it. And they push each other forward.
So do you really believe that if people spent less time talking about politics, they would do more actual politicking?
It's a very hard question to answer. You know, I kind of put it to the reader of the book. I mean, do you actually want power for your side? Maybe you don't, and you're just happy kind of consuming all this information. And okay, just so you know, other people out there want power more than you do, obviously. And in the book, I talk about groups like the KKK who are out helping opioid addicts, saying, hey, your opioid addiction is not your fault, and we're here to help you. Come visit us.
Yeah, this was the KKK in North Carolina in 2018.
That's right. And so if you're comfortable with that, yeah, like I'm happy. I'm sitting on my couch. I'm pretty comfortable. And other people who want power will go out and do the dirty work, then fine. But I think a lot of people feel sad about the state of political affairs and they don't know what they should be doing. And so I want to show them, hey, actually, there's something you can do. And it's getting power for your side, for your views, for your issues. And that requires you to change people's minds about whether they're going to vote and who they're going to vote for.
A fascinating part of your book was a description in the 1950s of what the political scientist James Q. Wilson called amateur Democrats, which were very much like today's hobbyists.
That's right. With one exception, they were involved in community meetings in their neighborhoods. Folks in professional jobs after the war, they really resisted the party machine. You know, in cities like New York, it was corrupt and it wasn't supportive of liberal values. And so this professional class formed what was a short-term movement of what was called Club Democrats. And they met in clubhouses and in living rooms and they had cocktails or coffee and they talked big ideas.
So they had a social scene, but not one that would prompt them to canvass, for instance.
That's right. It was hard to get them to see value in organizing a neighborhood, in, you know, helping a neighbor with their potholes. That's what the machines were really good at. The machines were bad in a lot of ways, but the machines were good when they were good at responding to people who maybe politics wasn't important to them, but they did care that someone was there fixing their potholes or fixing their streetlight. Or maybe there's examples in, say, Chicago's machine of Mayor Daley, cash assistance. The amateurs hated all that. They wanted politics to be about these big ideas. They cared about liberal values, civil rights, but they didn't want to dirty their hands in grassroots organizing.
Because it was a little dirty.
You know, power can corrupt, but if you really want something out of politics, you have to actually make this choice. Empower leaders in your community, and they might burn you. But they're also the only vehicle we have for power for good things.
And when you're talking about people who feel detached or sad about politics, all the indications are that cable news or too much social media or news consumption in general will deplete you, whereas actual engagement can invigorate you.
Right. In the same way that all community engagement, whether it's religious or civic, is correlated with being happier, this is too. I think if you kind of imagine an in-person version of politics based on what you experience on social media, it just seems awful. It's angry. It's antagonistic. How could a liberal convince a Fox News viewer to take their side or vice versa? But then you go to a community meeting like that one in rural Pennsylvania or one anywhere in the country, and you see something much different, much more uplifting and positive, where they slow and steady move people in their direction. So I think it's just a much more positive experience than people imagine it to be.
Writing in The Cut recently, the day after the assassination of General Soleimani, writer Bridget Reed describe the sensation of watching the stream of reactions on Twitter. She wrote, "It was terrifying to be suddenly aware of how much time and attention I've given over to this strange place where everything happens, but nothing happens. Convincing me I'm doing something when I'm doing nothing, risking nothing. Or worse, there's nothing else I can actually do or risk, when of course there is."
I think politics seems so sad online often because we follow these news stories, and they're big news stories, at least at any time they seem big. The Mueller report seemed so big, and the Ukraine story and impeachment, these are big historical moments. But my role as a citizen in those moments is not important. I'm not important to what's happening in the impeachment or what's happening with the military in Iran. But I am important if I place myself in a community.
Eitan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Eitan Hersh is a political science professor at Tufts and author of Politics is for Power, How to Move Beyond Political Hobbyism, Take Action, and Make Real Change. Coming up, two families that feud with most of the nation. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. For those who were tuned in to the TV Wednesday night, on any of the cable news channels, they'd have seen snippets of Rachel Maddow interviewing Rudy Giuliani associate Lev Parnas. Wait, who?
I don't know him at all. Don't know what he's about. Don't know where he comes from. Know nothing about him.
He lied. I mean, we're not friends. I mean, when you say friends, I mean, me and him didn't watch football games together. We didn't eat hot dogs. But he knew exactly who we were. He knew exactly who
Parnas told Maddow that Giuliani, Attorney General William Barr, Vice President Mike Pence, and others were all on the president's team, charged with unseating American-Ukraine Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, a move favored by Ukrainian oligarchs, in exchange for helping secure the president's seat by doing damage to Joe Biden. How we got to the point where the interests of company and country are brazenly conflated out there for most to see is the subject of my WNYC colleague Andrea Bernstein's new book called American Oligarchs, The Kushners, the Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. We'll begin on a rainy night, September 1943, in the ghetto of Nowogródek, Poland, where a couple hundred survivors tunneled 300 meters to escape their Nazi captors. Among them was Ray Kushner, grandmother of Jared, and hiding in a hole in the ground of a nearby forest was his eventual grandfather, Jassel Berkowitz, a carpenter. The two made their way to Hungary, married, and then walked across and around borders, detained a few years in an Italian refugee camp, until, after strategically lying to American immigration officials about their family relations and nationality, the United States lets them in. There, Jassel Berkowitz, now called Joseph Kushner, begins to build the family fortune.
He starts by working on houses in New Jersey as a carpenter. And it is a great time to be in carpentry because there's so many houses that are being built for the returning GIs and there's so much federal money flowing into suburbia. And he becomes a millionaire many times over through his own moxie, certainly, but also with a great deal of help from the government.
Let's talk about Friedrich Trump now. We start his story earlier, basically at the turn of the 20th century.
It's the Gilded Age. So as now, huge inequality of wealth and monopolists control the government. One of the things that's different, though, between now and then is that there was a lot of land which the U.S. had seized from the native populations, but they were giving it away. And there was a lot of immigration, and those two combined things meant you could still change your social class. So Friedrich Trump gets in the hospitality business, locating his establishments where there are a lot of gold miners, and he sells liquor, food, and access to sex.
How did they find their way back east?
So he gets back to New York at a period where Queens is about to get a bridge. And it's about to get very easy to get to Queens, which means all the land is going to have a lot of value. He buys land in Queens right before this big government infrastructure project. And that is hugely beneficial to his real estate business. Friedrich dies of the Spanish flu, and the Trump family did suffer during the Great Depression. Donald's father, Fred Trump, is building houses, but it wasn't until he really learned how to work the system in the mid-1930s and develop political ties that the Trump family business, as we know it, was born.
The Kushners and the Trumps benefited enormously from the New Deal programs of FDR and from institutional racism.
We know the story of what happened. White people were fleeing cities. That flow of population to the suburbs helped the Kushner family also the Trump family. Fred Trump's real estate projects were what is known in political circles as white ethnic enclaves. It's an active practice in the Trump family to keep black families out. The Justice Department at one point brings suit against Donald and Fred Trump. They settle, but they admit no wrongdoing. But they say, OK, we're actually not going to discriminate going forward. Dubious whether their promise was kept.
Both Charles Kushner, Jared's dad, and Fred were active participants in local Democratic politics. Charlie Kushner, at one point, was New Jersey's top Democratic donor.
Really big money in those days.
So what did they get for that money?
First and second generation immigrant families of Holocaust survivors had a group called the Holocaust Builders in New Jersey that made a lot of money but didn't talk about it. Charlie wanted the attention, but he also wanted the government benefits in much the same way that Donald Trump's father, Fred Trump, had sought. When you're in the real estate business, your entire business model depends on government favors. It depends on zoning, perhaps tax givebacks. So it's very important that you cultivate politicians. What was different about Charlie Kushner is he did it so aggressively that he actually got in trouble for it, which
How?
Is a rare thing. Well, Charlie Kushner's older brother Murray objected to the fact that Charlie Kushner was using their corporate accounts to write checks to politicians, to pay for entertainment, things that you're not supposed to pay for from a corporation in America because that is tax evasion. So Murray sued him. A person that notices the lawsuit is the U.S. Attorney of New Jersey at the time.
I'm Christopher Christie. I'm the United States Attorney in the District of New Jersey. The six indictments, including three RICO indictments that were brought today in New Jersey.
He's trying to build his own career as this corruption-busting Republican U.S. attorney. And here comes this case of a Democratic donor doing blatant wrongdoing, and it proves irresistible. Charlie Kushner does what rich people do, hires a white-collar lawyer to make it go away. And the lawyer cannot make it go away. So Charlie decides to take matters into his own hands. He hires a sex worker to entrap his sister's husband, who he also thinks is working against him. And there is an encounter in a motel that Charlie has videotaped. Some months later, he learns that Christie's prosecution is going forward. And he has the videotape sent over to his sister on the eve of her son's engagement party. His sister brought it to the U.S. Attorney's office, and Charlie was subsequently charged with witness tampering, tax evasion, campaign finance violations.
Kushner's high-profile defense attorneys say their client is innocent of the charges.
Everyone knows Mr. Kushner is one of the most successful businessmen in the United States and one of the great philanthropists of this century.
He pleaded guilty in August of 2004.
We talk about tax evasion. The Trumps actually made quite a hobby of this.
So interesting, because in America in the middle of the last century, people believed in paying taxes. FDR said,
taxes, after all, are the dues that we pay for the privilege of membership in an organized society.
People believed that. You can look at the data and you can find there is actually not that much tax evasion, except the Trumps did. Fred Trump, when he wants to get federal mortgages, he says, look how much my property is worth. But when he wants to pay taxes, he says, look how much it's not worth. By the end of his life, he has given over $1 billion to his children, tax-free, including $400 million to his son, Donald.
Mm-hmm. A few times in your book, you have some variation on the phrase, largest fine in XYZ
yes.
commission history. So yeah. Some of the taxpayer money was clawed back.
The Trump Taj Mahal Casino was twice given the largest fine for loose money laundering controls in the history of the U.S. Treasury Department, twice. Trump, because of a scheme that he developed with Roger Stone, we all know Roger Stone, was given the largest lobbying fine in the history of New York State. But these were business expenses, if you will. They didn't actually deter him from his business practices because they weren't enough. It's like the theory of somebody who wants to drive fast and gets a speeding ticket now and then and understands, okay, I'm going to take that speeding ticket because it means the rest of the time I can drive fast.
So how about the process of reporting this book? You've noted that in the 20 years that you've investigated political corruption, it's become harder and harder to trace.
I cannot overstate what a challenge this reporting project was. There are so many shell companies. Sometimes it's like being in a nightmarish hallway where there's a million closed doors and you think, which one should I go into? It used to be not that hard to cover money in politics because people would disclose their donations somewhere. You could find the numbers and line them up with maybe a contract or some other government benefit. What's happening now is money pours into government through dark money committees, super PACs. It's sanctioned by the U.S. Supreme Court that you don't really have to say how money is getting into elections. You can spend a year figuring out, as some people have done, who was behind the LLC that gave $1 million to the Trump inaugural committee. One of the reasons why we have set up the collaboration that we have in our podcast, Trump Inc., is because it's a force multiplier. The Trump Inc. podcast is a collaboration of WNYC and ProPublica, but we've worked with a lot of journalists. We've worked with The New Yorker, The Washington Post, Bloomberg, Times, Forbes.
And listeners.
Citizens journalists, tipsters. There is so much to look at. And one of the things I found is, okay, just read everything. Read every document. Read it at least twice so you retain it. And that is one of the ways to overcome systems that are deliberately designed to keep us from learning about the Trump and Kushner family businesses.
Ray Kushner, who had escaped with her life just barely from the Nazis, from Poland, with the help of some lies strategically designed to mislead immigration services. Ray's children, for one of her birthdays, compiled a book about family lore, The Miracle of Life, and you drew from it a lot in your book. It begins with a quote from Proverbs, "Hear me, my child, the instruction of your father, and do not forsake the teaching of your mother." What lessons did Ray's children and grandchildren ultimately take?
This is the central conflict of the Kushner family. There are a lot of lessons that can be taken from the Holocaust experience. One lesson is flout authority, break rules. That is certainly a lesson that Jared Kushner and his father, Charlie Kushner, have embraced. Jared Kushner had to amend his disclosure forms 40 times. He communicates with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia via WhatsApp and doesn't tell intelligence agencies. So that is one lesson. Don't follow rules. Another lesson is wall yourself off. Don't let anybody in. Kill anybody that is trying to threaten you, because otherwise they'll get you. But there's another set of lessons from the Holocaust. Jared Kushner's grandmother, Ray Kushner, had a very specific warning.
If he's not going to tell now, in 20 years, I don't know who's going to be to tell. And now we have still this strength, and we have the power to do this and to warn the rest of the world to be careful. Who is coming up on top of your government?
And of course, her grandson is on top of a government that is presiding over the most restrictive refugee and immigration policies in generations in many ways. I want to be clear. We are not living in the Holocaust. It was a terrible and unique time in history. But one of the things I learned from The Origins of Totalitarianism by Hannah Arendt was the way the Nazis constantly assaulted the idea of truth, not just what was right and what was wrong, but the idea that they could say one thing and then say another thing and everybody would understand there were lies. You know, there's a connection between eroding a sense that there can be a truth and what is allowable and what can happen.
You quote Hannah Arendt saying, "The result of a consistent and total substitution of lies for factual truth is that the sense by which we take our bearings in the real world is being destroyed." So, Andrea, how did you keep your bearings while reporting this book?
I did rely on the old saws of journalism. Asking, 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 trying to get everybody who could explain something to me and every document that related to any aspect of the story.
But what about the notion that it's not so bad? There are worse things. Did you at any point fear that slippery slope?
I mean, yes. And, you know, then also all the people who are sort of, you know, why are you covering this? What's it going to do? But I'm a journalist. There's only one thing I can do, which is to try to document and put something into a story that people will understand. The moment that I stop doing that is when I have given up hope, and I have not given up hope.
It's a really good book, Andrea.
Thank you, Brooke.
Andrea Bernstein is co-host of WNYC's Trump, Inc., and the author of American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Micah Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chaturvedi. We had more help from Anthony Banzi and Eloise Blondio. Our engineers this week were Josh Hahn and Sam Baer. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.